What I know now, looking back, is that in 1991, Jeffrey Epstein had a very set strategy. He was a psychopath then, and he was a skilled, masterful manipulator.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I appreciate you joining us today because we have a very special guest today. Jess Michaels is one of the many victims of Jeffrey Epstein. And because Jeffrey Epstein has become such a central figure in our politics in this country, in this moment we're in, and because it has been a story that has illustrated a kind of corrupt approach to justice for the victims of people like Jeffrey Epstein, given what the White House is doing, given what the Justice Department has been doing, I'm really pleased to welcome Jess Michaels here today with us to have her tell her story so you start to get a little more of a picture of the kind of things that was happening to very young girls at the time who were unready and abused in because they weren't playing the same game that Jeffrey Epstein was playing. And it was a grim and terrible game. So I want to welcome you, Jess. Thank you so much for coming on the program today. I really appreciate your time. And I really appreciate you telling your story in the last few weeks, because I think it was easy for a long time for people to think this was just a faceless group of anonymous women and young girls. Tell us your story about how you fell into Jeffrey Epstein's web.
Yes, thank you so much for having me, Rick. I like to remind people that Jeffrey Epstein didn't just assault children, that he also abused young women, women that were in their early, you know, late teens, that 18 to 23-year-old age range, 25-year-old age range. And we're at that stage in our life where we're launching into the world. And so when I share my story, I like to be really clear that I was a very successful, thriving young dancer and model. I was succeeding in my career. I had an incredible trajectory ahead of me. I was confident. I was assertive. I had wonderful relationships. I was thriving in my life. And I came back from a contract in Tokyo where I was dancing and modeling. And my roommate at the time, a very dear friend who I'd known for a year and a half, the whole time that I had been working professionally, and she was telling me about this man that she had been working for the last few months, who was training her in massage, taking her on trips around the world where she only had to do two or three massages in a week, and then she'd have the rest of the time to herself. And what is really important about that aspect is she had actually been doing it for a while. She spoke very highly of him.
Right.
She did not give me any indication that there was any concern. In fact, what she told me made me jealous. It was a perfect side job for a dancer to do, to be able to go to auditions and leave on contracts and then come home and have that same job back. That's a really rare thing for a performing artist in New York City.
Sure.
So I was jealous. She's making all this money. And then a couple of months go by and she tells me she's gotten a dance contract and Jeffrey needs a backup masseuse. What I didn't understand at the time was I was actually being groomed. And the way I like to speak of her, I call her the Ghislaine Maxwell before there was a Ghislaine Maxwell, because this is in 1991. It's one of the reasons why I put 1991 in my bio, because I want to be really clear and remind people that this was going on so much longer than anyone wants to discuss. So I actually saved all my day planners because I'm an avid journaler. So I have a 1991 day planner that has his name, his Madison Avenue address, his phone number, and the assistant's name at the time when I went down to that address. And I went into his office and he was very stoic. He was very professional when I first met him. And he made me feel like this was a very serious job. He was looking for only serious candidates. He knew so much about the body. He was asking me questions about the body in a way that made me feel insecure, but set him up as the authority, that he knew a lot and he was going to be the trainer. And at one point, I wasn't even sure if I was going to get the job. He asks me to come around the back of the desk, and he opens up a drawer, that deeper file cabinet drawer. You know what I'm talking about, like in a desk.
Sure.
And opens it up. There's about a dozen books of the Book of Massage in there. And he hands me a copy, and I have to study this. What I know now, looking back, is that in 1991, Jeffrey Epstein had a very set strategy. He was a psychopath then, and he was a skilled, masterful manipulator.
Right.
So being the overachiever that I am, he gives me this book, and I don't even know if I have the job, and I go and I get a three-subject notebook, and I study it, and my roommate gets home that afternoon, and she says, he liked you, and you're going to call his office and make an appointment for a trial massage. So I'm thinking I'm good, because I know if you hand me something to do, I'm gonna do my utmost to excel at it. I receive the address the next week, and it is to go to this penthouse. And the penthouse doors open up into this foyer, and I walk around this foyer, and it is a gorgeous penthouse. So when I saw his office, I had a hard time believing he was a millionaire, because it was such a stark, bare office. When I walked into that penthouse, I knew this was a space I had never seen anything like it before. There was a sunken living room. There were floor-to-ceiling windows. It was really a beautiful place. Jeffrey comes out in a white bathrobe and a towel. And I, being the assertive, confident dancer that I am, my first question is, so why do you hire professional dancers when clearly you could hire professional masseuses? And he says, oh, well, dancers have such beautiful bodies. They know how to take care of themselves. You know, they know more about the body than the average professional does. And you wouldn't want a fat personal trainer, would you? And then he proceeds to do a pushing of the boundary. He takes off his bathrobe, doesn't look at me, and he says, and dancers are comfortable with nudity. He doesn't look at me. He doesn't ask me. He doesn't check in. He just acts like this is completely normal.
Sure.
It is after that. I'm not going to go into the longer details. We only have 20 or 30 minutes here. But what I will tell you is that it is a typical pattern of manipulators and sex offenders to continually groom and push lines until I was raped. And Rick, what I will tell you about my advocacy, the reason I speak out and the reason I worked so hard for 7 years in trauma therapy to talk about this is because I did what is the most common trauma response. Trauma response happened to me. I froze. And he finished and he threw money on the table, said, hey, call my office next week for another appointment. He normalized everything that had just happened. And I was so confused and petrified. And if we don't start talking about trauma responses as a society, people are never going to understand why survivors, what happens afterwards. I got on the subway
It's not the movies, folks.
It is. I've never seen Hollywood depict an accurate rape scenario. And so I got on the subway going the wrong way. I showed up for work the next day. I was still mute. And my friend is asking me, hey, how did it go yesterday? And by the time she asked me three times, I hadn't answered. And I just looked at her and she looked at me. She grabbed my hand and brought me into an office. And I just crumbled and started crying. And I will always remember this fact that I was too humiliated to tell her everything that happened. And she still said to me, It's time to go to the police. We have to go to the police. It was only then that I recognized what had happened. And Rick, what people don't understand about 1991 is at that time, what we understood about laws were that you were considered raped based on how much you resisted. And if you froze, it was then not considered rape. And so not only did I not think anyone was going to believe me, I didn't even believe myself. It was where the self-blame began. And I cowered. And that really confident, vibrant, thriving young woman at 22 years old just collapsed. I lost a sense of trust in myself. I didn't trust my body. I didn't trust anyone around me. And I didn't trust the world. I didn't feel safe walking around in the world anymore. I really struggled to believe that I wasn't stupid, that it was absolutely my fault, and it would take decades before I saw his face again and then was able to actually get therapy and recognize what had actually happened. But I also think it's really important to understand that in 1991, I thought I was the only one. I could not believe that my friend would have brought me to this place,
right,
and that he would have been doing the same thing. So I'm going to stop so that you get a chance to chime in. But that's what happened.
It's riveting and it's horrifying. But I mean, it so fits in with what we understand the pattern continued to be until the mid-2000s. And after Joanne Maxwell entered the chat, of taking young girls who, many of whom are, they may be adults, but they are not yet mature adults.
No.
They have not yet had that experiential collision with the world where you get certain abilities of judgment about people and things in the same way that you want to have or you will have later. But that pattern iterated over and over again. And what I'm asking is, as you saw him emerge again, as you saw the stories eventually, you must have felt in a strange way that sense that you weren't alone in it must have been both tragic and yet it probably, I'm guessing, helped you feel like you weren't the only person who had made this, you know, had fallen into this horrifying trap with this guy.
Yes, that's exactly. It was equally triggering and upsetting to see his face again. My body responded before I even knew whether it was actually him, because I couldn't remember the name, but there was something about his face. When I saw the news, Julie K. Brown's Perversion of Justice, I saw his face and I'm looking at his face and I start to shake and I'm having a hard time breathing and I'm starting to sweat and my heart starts racing and I wasn't even sure if it was him. So I just went to go look for my day planners and I found my day planner and then I started reading the articles and the article. And at the same time that I am so triggered, I'm in my brain, I'm going, oh my God, it was never my fault. It wasn't my fault. I wasn't the only one. And it was this equally lifting of shame while I'm being triggered. It was a very bizarre feeling.
I can imagine it had to be an extraordinarily complex sort of melange of emotions at that time.
Yes.
Because when you learn the scope of what Epstein had done, from at least now we have you're one of the alpha cases here that we know of, at least as far back as 1991, probably earlier.
Definitely earlier, yeah.
Through the mid-2000s. And you know, as I've told a million people, if you think Jeffrey Epstein stopped doing what he was doing while he was on house arrest after the state case in Florida, I have a bridge to sell you.
Yeah.
These kind of sexual predators and abusers always continue their behavior until they are stopped.
Yeah, definitely.
And you know, it is something that I think, you know, you and other victims who are now coming forward are really in an unusual position, because a lot of sexual assault survivors, they want to be done.
Yeah.
They want to work it through maybe, and and not talk about it and not keep bringing it up and not have it in their face for the rest of their life. But I really think it's commendable that you and the other survivors of this are telling the stories of Epstein, because he has become something that is very central to what's going on in our country about how we treat the law, how we treat the victims of abuse.
Let me start by asking you, I mean, this nightmare has followed you for a very, very long time. I mean, decades. And I'm sure that Jeffrey Epstein's reemergence, I mean, all over the news, has been incredibly painful. How are you? How are you doing? Yes. How are you digesting all of this?
Thank you for asking that. That's very thoughtful, because a lot of people aren't aware of every time his picture is on one of their podcasts or, you know, and I've asked several people, can you please not just flash his picture everywhere or Maxwell's and not glamorize them? But thank you for asking that, because a lot of people aren't aware that that re-traumatizes victims every time we have to see his face. And it's a case that has just never gone away. It just won't go away. And I need your audience to understand that, you know, I reported this almost three decades ago. So a lot of people will say, oh, why is she just coming forward now? And they think it's political. And it's not. It's something I've been working on. Pretty much I dedicated all of my youth to this. And so I'm doing it not just for me, but for the victims who are now deceased and the victims that are very much alive. And I want to get justice for all of them. I feel that for my little sister to have gone through what she went through and to have had to testify against Maxwell and then have to suffer, and there are others that I love very much who are suffering this right now about Maxwell, it's completely unacceptable. Why would Maxwell be given a voice when she is a convicted pedophile? It's been very difficult, and I appreciate the question. I appreciate you asking.
Of course, and I think we're all grateful for you having the courage to be here and tell your story and be out there.
And because the president of the United States was a close friend of Jeffrey Epstein, we now have his stage two facilitator, Ghislaine Maxwell, being transferred from a medium security prison to a club fed.
Child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein's co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, was transferred to a minimum security prison in Texas. The move triggered speculation that she's getting special treatment for answering Department of Justice questions about the Epstein case in which she was convicted. Fox 4's Casey Stegall in studio with more. Casey.
Clarice, good evening. The Federal Bureau of Prisons, in fact, offered no explanation behind Ghislaine Maxwell's transfer from a Florida prison to a less secure prison camp here in Texas. Legal analysts have their own theories as calls grow for the Department of Justice to release all of the files relating to the Jeffrey Epstein case. The FPC, or Federal Prison Camp in Bryan, about 20 minutes from Texas A&M, is the new home for Jeffrey Epstein's former girlfriend and associate, Ghislaine Maxwell. It's a minimum security women's prison where other high-profile inmates are housed, like Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes and former Real Housewife reality star Jennifer Shaw. Not a place typically reserved for someone convicted of sex-related crimes like Maxwell was in June of 2022.
It's highly unusual and highly unconventional.
Jeremy Rosenthal is a criminal defense lawyer. Though not directly involved in the Epstein or Maxwell case, he believes the transfer's timing is no coincidence.
Based on the amount of time that she spent with the attorneys, doing the interview, I think clearly there's a lot of information being divulged.
Just last week, Maxwell was questioned in Florida by the DOJ regarding her involvement in helping Jeffrey Epstein procure underage girls to abuse.
At the top level, she's clearly angling for some type of a pardon, which is a political question, one that the president, you would think that that would be a radioactive choice, at least at the moment.
Questions have been raised over President Trump's former relationship with the disgraced financier. The president recently told the press Epstein was kicked out of Mar-a-Lago years ago for, quote, stealing young women who worked in the spa.
He took people that worked for me, and I told him, don't do it anymore, and he did it, and I said, stay the hell out of here.
The Justice Department last month said it would not release any further documents related to the Epstein case. Democrats hope to circumvent that through a law from the 1920s known as the Rule of Five, which requires government agencies to hand over information if any five lawmakers on a House or Senate committee request it.
We're invoking federal law and using our authority as a check on the executive to compel transparency.
Relatives of Epstein victims, meantime, say Maxwell is being shown leniency. In a statement to Fox News, the family of Virginia Giuffre, who died by suicide earlier this year, says, quote, the American public should be enraged by the preferential treatment being given to a pedophile and a criminally charged child sex offender. A senior administration official calls the allegation absurd.
Meantime, Maxwell's attorneys have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to hear an appeal on their client's 2021 conviction. Today, the chair of the House Oversight Committee delayed a congressional deposition of Maxwell until after the high court weighs in.
We now have all the signs she's about to get pardoned and set free. And I know Maxwell was not the person who engineered your situation, but how do you feel about watching, and how do you think the other victims feel about watching this Maxwell story play out, where it's such an obvious trade-off? Don't say anything about Trump and you can go free, even though you're a sexual predator and a monster.
I want to say something before I even answer that question. None of the young women and girls that encountered Ghislaine Maxwell or Jeffrey Epstein had a chance. They were no match. I was no match for him in 1991. He was already masterful then. So none of these young women, I have to say that, because I hear all the victim blaming of, well, why did they go back? A lot of times in abuse situations, people think someone is choosing between safe and unsafe. And that's not what was happening. They had really fine-tuned it down to finding girls where their level of unsafe was just a little bit better than the unsafe they were living in. And that's important for people to understand that the amount of coercion and manipulation involved. So I just have to say that as an advocate. As far as the injustice goes, it is unfathomable to me that this administration is listening to a convicted pedophile. I actually just listened to some commentator say, "Yeah, she's just a scapegoat. She's not really guilty." The line we are going to is like, we're not even listening to victims anymore. And victims are, the victims are saying, not only are we willing to speak up now and on September 3rd, but they're saying, release the files. You can redact our names, but release the files. I haven't talked to anyone that has said, no, I don't want those files released.
Yeah, I mean, that strikes me as something that The initial claim that Bondi made about not releasing the Epstein materials was, there's a lot of child sexual abuse material in these files. We can't release them. We can't show it. No one cares about redacting those things. Yep. They should be redacted. If they're videos or whatever, absolutely redact them, edit them, blur them out, whatever the case. But I think that it really is a fundamental, and it astounds me that Pam Bondi, has been so corrupt in this on one level.
So disappointing.
In February, I did an interview on Fox, and it's been getting a lot of attention because I was asked a question about the client list, and my response was, it's sitting on my desk to be reviewed, meaning the file along with the JFK, MLK files as well. That's what I meant by that. Also, to the tens of thousands of video, they turned out to be child porn downloaded by that disgusting Jeffrey Epstein. Child porn is what they were. Never going to be released, never going to see the light of day. To him being an agent, I have no knowledge about that. We can get back to you on that. and the minute missing from the video, we released the video showing definitively the video was not conclusive, but the evidence prior to it was showing he committed suicide. And what was on that, there was a minute that was off the counter. And what we learned from Bureau of Prisons was every year, every night, they redo that video. It's old, from like 1999. So every night the video is reset, and every night should have the same minute missing. So we're looking for that video to release that as well, showing that a minute is missing every night. And that's it on Epstein.
Because when she was Attorney General of Florida, she made a great show about being an advocate for victims of sexual abuse and sexual assault. She was one of her big pillar items as Attorney General. And now she is enabling this pardon to go forward. She clearly was the person who ordered the 1,000 FBI agents to go through the hundreds of thousands of pages of material and redact Trump's name from them. I mean, so I really do think it's like, this is like they're being victimized a second time by this process, in my view.
I think the hard thing is too, and you know, I was not a victim of Ghislaine Maxwell. I didn't go through what many of these survivors are going through, but I can't imagine how they're feeling, because for me, seeing his face over and over and over in the media, knowing that there are hundreds of thousands of pieces of evidence, hundreds of thousands of files and pieces of evidence, and we can't get an investigation or a prosecution with that, how is that setting a precedent, a very scary precedent in our country, around what is going to be considered prosecutable. And in this particular crime of sexual assault, it is already so hard to even get a case into a courtroom. And then 2.5% of that 10% actually gets convicted. And so we actually get one. We actually have one. We have Ghislaine Maxwell in prison, and she gets moved to a country club, and she's doing yoga and Pilates, when I know survivors, Epstein and Maxwell survivors right now, are struggling to even make it through a night of sleep while she's taking yoga and Pilates.
It would unwind everything that my sister and all the survivors fought for. It would be a disgrace of justice. It would be picking abusers over survivors again.
That was Sky Roberts, the brother of Virginia Giuffre, a very prominent accuser of Jeffrey Epstein. You just watched it. You just heard it. You can hear the pain, the victims, their families, they are still enduring from Epstein's crimes.
Yeah, and that to me is one of the biggest outrages of this, is that I just don't want to hear this administration say that they're tough on crime when they're freeing a child trafficker and a sex trafficker. When they're giving her privileges, she's the only sexual predator in a minimum security federal prison. The only one. And I just find that, I find it such a deeply sort of disturbing and horrible indicator of how corrupt this situation is. So you mentioned the survivors are going to come together on September 3rd. Talk to us a little bit about that event.
So as I understand it, there's going to be a press conference with two representatives, a Democrat and a Republican, that are coming together for this Transparency Act with survivors who have never spoken up before.
What is most insulting is her dismissal of the victims. It was offensive. Thomas Massie and I are having 10 of the victims on September 3rd at the Capitol to tell their story. We need to center the victims. That is going to be an explosive press conference, and it's going to show how abused these women were and how reprehensible it is that Maxwell is dismissing that.
We are hoping to unite in a show of force that that has never been done before by survivors of this, this horrific man. There's no reason why this case should have been closed with the volume of evidence. And we don't care who it is. we don't care if it's Democrat, Republican. I don't care if it's independent. I don't 100%. Care if it's progressive. We don't care. But victims have done everything right. The government and the FBI and even the Southern District of Florida have destroyed protocols, hop, skipped, and jumped over protocols, either by negligence, because of known negligence, or just out of incompetence. And so there has been very little accountability or justice, and it's very disturbing.
I think you made a couple points in there that I think are really important. One is, and I speak for myself, but I speak for, I think, almost everyone who believes in this, whether they're Republican or Democrat. I don't care who is in the files.
Yep.
If it's Bill Clinton, okay. Mm-hmm. If it's Alan Dershowitz, okay. I don't care. It does not matter. I think that one of the inequities here that is so fundamental is this idea that powerful people are in these materials, significant people of consequence in the financial industry or in politics, and that we would hide them because they are those people. That is a perversion of justice that is absolutely out of control.
Yes. Yes. And we're looking at a second sweetheart deal here for Ghislaine Maxwell. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the two prosecutions of these people have been de minimis in their actual impact on their lives.
Yeah. And I have to say, when Pam Bondi came out with those binders in February, I had the tiny sliver of hope that there would be something revealed, something would come out.
Right.
The tiniest sliver. I mean, tiny. Tiny.
Attorney General Bondi says this is just phase one. She's promising to open the government files on Jeffrey Epstein, but despite the hype, most of what she released so far had been made public years ago.
Overnight, the Justice Department releasing material about the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, including a three-page evidence list cataloging what investigators obtained while searching his New York mansion and private Caribbean island. Among the items listed, a photo album of Girl and Epstein, a bag containing one set of copper handcuffs and whip, along with dozens of computers, hard drives, and recording devices, and a folder containing LSJ logbook, a reference to Epstein's island, Little St. James. Attorney General Pam Bondi went on TV to trumpet the release of this material, teasing a big reveal.
What you're going to see, hopefully tomorrow, is a lot of flight logs, a lot of names, a lot of information. But it's pretty sick what that man did.
But much of the material had been circulating in the public domain for years, including pilot logs from Epstein's plane and his so-called black book of names and addresses. Several conservative media figures were given early access during a visit to the White House, showing off binders and posing for pictures, some later posting how underwhelmed they were. Epstein died by suicide in jail before he could be tried on sex trafficking charges. His former paramour, Ghislaine Maxwell, was convicted and is now considering an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Attorney General Bondi is promising to release more documents after a review to protect the identities of victims.
Yeah, as I like to say to people, when it comes to this administration, reduce your expectations to zero. But
tiny. But what I never expected was for the case to be completely closed and the files to be sealed. No one could have expected that that would happen. And that is egregious. And that is an injustice to not just the Epstein and Maxwell survivors, but to every survivor that has ever been silenced. Every single survivor, I will tell you in my comments and in my DMs and in my emails, are sexual assault survivors relating to Epstein survivors and saying, we are with you. We can see what's happening here. And this has happened to us.
Yeah, it is the type of people who become those. That kind of character, the gaslighting, the manipulation, is at a scale and a level that ordinary people never encounter. Yeah. And thank God they never encounter it, because it's horrific. But I think that you know, what's deserved here is openness and candor and transparency and accountability.
Exactly.
And the sick irony is we're not gonna get that unless survivors like you and the other survivors are out there front and center. And so I really salute you for doing this. And I really think it's a enormously courageous and meritorious that you're doing this. I want to ask you one more question. Yeah. You have become an advocate for sexual assault. Talk to us a little bit about your work in that space.
Thank you so much for asking. So there's a reason why I became an advocate. When I started to recognize how my life had been completely derailed by living with post-traumatic stress disorder after the assault, and how it had detrimentally affected my physical health, my emotional health, my relationships, my career tanked. And I really felt like there was this gap in care for survivors, and it was based on societal stigma and shame, that lack of understanding about what we freeze, that is actually a really common response. It happens a lot to women, and it happens actually, you know, I've had combat veterans say, you know, yes, ma'am, we freeze too. So do police officers. It happens. But for some reason, it's ignored in sexual assault survivors, and it's considered not prosecutable. So what I'm recognizing is that people around us need to treat us like we have an injury. And so I've created something called like sexual assault first aid. It's where people just understand they know what to do when someone says me too. And it's in the form of an app. It's called With You Too. It's a social safety app. And it just helps us take care of each other better daily. And then in the event of a crisis.
That's fascinating, though, because it's like you know, most people forget how to perform CPR, and a lot of them get an app and say, do these compressions. So this is the same kind of approach?
It's the same thing. And because if I told you, Rick, awesome, last night I was raped, for your first response is, oh, we got to go to the police, because everybody treats it as a crime. And what we are trying to show in this app, and it's very trauma-informed app, is like, sexual harm is an injury first before it's an interrogation. And so there is a step that needs to happen before we just shove people, victims, off to strangers. We need to surround them in safety, trust, and support, calm their nervous system down, make them feel safe, and then help them along the way to look at all of their options of what to do next. Sure. The problem is that a survivor is often navigating all of that alone, traumatized.
I think that is a really, really wise and smart way to help the friends of these people. And unfortunately, it is an extraordinarily common occurrence.
It is sadly common. And people don't say the right thing, not because they're terrible people. It's because we don't talk about this issue. It's one of the reasons why I worked so hard to develop my language around it and to be able to speak what happened. Because I think that's also why we've been on this hamster wheel of nothing happening, is that trauma survivors have been so stuck in trauma. And that area of the brain that is affected by speech is affected by sexual harm, and we can't get to our words. That's why I'm so honored whenever I'm asked to speak, because I've worked really hard to get here to find those words and explain what happened so that we can try to prevent people from being left alone again.
Well, Jess Michaels, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Lincoln Project podcast today. I am deeply moved by how you've articulated your story, and by what you've done since then to convert some of that pain and hurt and injury into publicly facing advocacy that will hopefully help folks survive this. And I want to, you know, thank you and the other folks who are going to be there on the 3rd to speak out about this, because I think it's something that there's a massive political power system in this country trying to suppress this story.
Yeah.
And to suppress this, the victims of this story. And I'm really proud of you guys for taking that. I know it's a huge step to be out there in public in front of the cameras with the Trump hate machine ready to turn itself on. Yeah. And I just want to say this personally, if you guys need somebody to tell you how to fight back on that front when these bastards start coming after you, and they will, you call me.
Thank you, Rick.
Because I'll show up with a tire iron.
I'm counting on it.
You got it.
Okay, folks, thank you so much for listening, as always, to the Lincoln Project podcast. I'm your host, Rick Wilson. You can catch me on the Enemies List podcast, the Elephant in the Room podcast, streaming three times a week on the strategy session on Tuesday nights, the breakdown on Thursday nights, and Behind the Numbers with the Wilsons on Fridays, where we break down the national polling situation and we talk about where the numbers are and the politics landscape is in the country. You can also join us on my Substack at The Rick Wilson and on the Lincoln Square Substack. We appreciate all of your support. We will continue this fight as long as you guys help us stay in it. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks so much, everybody.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.